We have absolutely no structure, so this is just a conversation about whatever you might like to talk about. So if you have no subjects, we have no conversation. So I will push the recorder. Okay?
I have a question.
Okay. Catherine?
What we spoke about at lunch, I'd like to know why they, I know that the teachings are pretty much the same with the Ananda group. I think they're called self-realization.
Fellowship.
And the guy I've been studying with for 20 years has been doing that for many, probably that long, 20 years.
Okay.
Savitri mentioned that something about communal living was one of the issues. But that doesn't seem like that's the whole thing.
No, that's a manifest. Well, I mean, it's not untrue. Depends on what level you ask the question. Do all of you know about what Self-Realization Fellowship is, or shall I also say that? Okay, when Yogananda came to America in 1920, in 1925, I mentioned last night he crisscrossed the country giving lectures, and eventually he settled in Los Angeles. When he settled in Los Angeles, he eventually bought a big building. It was a big hotel on Mount Washington in Los Angeles. And unlike many avatars who just sail through and never leave a trace, he actually established an organization. Because this whole movement was so new in America, he couldn't. Like in India, if a great master arises, everybody knows who he is and they cluster around and they all know what to do with it. In America, nobody knew what to do with it, so he did what we do in America, which is he founded a church, essentially. Although he didn't exactly call it that. Well, he did. He called it a church. He called it Self-Realization Fellowship, which is in itself a very interesting name. Self-realization is a completely individual relationship with God, but saying Self-Realization Fellowship, you know, just is a teaching all by itself, because we're going to do the search for God, but we're going to do it together. And so he founded that in 1925, and he incorporated it as a California church, and it became his organization. And he naturally put a lot of energy behind it to make it work. When he died in 1952, it was the only organization. No, that's not true. Even by the time he died, one of his disciples, Paramananda, or Premananda in Washington, D.C., had established on his own another self-realization branch that was not Self-Realization Fellowship, but he was a disciple of Master, and he started his own organization on that side. Self-Realization Fellowship, pretty much as soon as Yogananda passed away, his immediate successor was a man named Rajasi. Rajasi very quickly developed a brain tumor and became incapacitated in any external way, and within a couple of years he died. So the next successor after him was a woman named Dayamata, who only died last November at 96. So basically, since Yogananda, since Master, there's just been this one woman who's been in charge. And so the whole trajectory of SRF, which is as commonly called after Master died, was defined by this woman, Dayamata. Swami Kriyananda, of course, was part of SRF, because when you came to live with Master, that's what you were part of. There was no other thought. But you were really living in the ashram of Guru, and you had a disciple. You had a master, and you were a disciple. The organization existed, but it was just a container for what Master was doing. It wasn't an end in itself. It was just a means to achieve the end, which was to focalize things enough to pass it forward. And then Swami Kriyananda was 3.5 years in 1952 as a disciple. Master died. Kriyananda stayed in SRF until 1962, a total of 14 years. During that time, he gradually rose to extreme prominence in SRF. He became the head of one of their churches. Master had made him the head of the monks. He led all the departments that dealt with all the centers. He was, you know, training the teachers. Pretty much he defined the organization. He was the only prominent man. He was the only really prominent man, and all the other leaders were women. And they were even a couple of family groups together. And interestingly, they were almost all Mormons in their background. Unbelievable. And most of them came to Master as young women, even teenagers, even younger than that, or just early teens or late teens. And they'd only ever lived in this monastic situation. Swami Kriyananda, how shall we put it mildly, did not fit. you know, it was a classic sort of male-female conflict. The women were nursing the nest, and he wanted to go out and conquer universes. And even though he was eventually made vice president, Diamata was always the president, and she was always very much in charge. And her concept of how we were going to progress this work never matched Swami Kriyananda's concept of it. But he was loyal, and he kept working on it. So in 1958, Swami Kriyananda was sent by that organization to India to work on the work in India. When he got to India, his perspective on what Master's teachings really are shifted very radically, because India is not organizationally based in its spirituality. One of the reasons spirituality has remained vibrant in India for all these years is nobody ever tries to bring it under an organizational umbrella. The philosophy there is, among other things, they understand that avatars and saints are a recurring phenomenon. And so when somewhat of inspiration rises, everybody clusters around, takes the blessings of that person, learns from them. The disciples take what they've learned and they go off and spread the good news. And nobody's in charge. And they don't feel any need to define the orthodoxy and the heretics. And they don't feel the need to fight about all of that. Their philosophy is very simple. If it's inspiring, people will follow it. And when it ceases to inspire them, they'll stop following it. And nobody needs to worry about it. So he realized when he got to India that SRF was developing, well, pretty much like the Catholic Church, which is with the Orthodox and the unorthodox and the authorities and the people who aren't the authorities, and the higher up you are in the organization, the more spiritual you are, and the president naturally knows the most, you know, just all like that. And he saw when he got to India that that was just all made up. That really wasn't. And Swami always knew that. He sort of makes this a little bit. He tells the story a little bit in this way. But he always knew that, but it just utterly confirmed for him. Plus, he was finally out from underneath the direct veto power of the female board of directors. And he was, 34 years old or something by that point. And really wanted to do what he knew he could do. And so he just started developing the work in India. And he was phenomenally successful. He had literally thousands of people coming to his talks. He became known as the American Swami. And, you know, he has a beautiful voice. He sang Bengali songs. He learned to speak Bengali and a little bit of Hindi. And he was just, he's a world citizen. He was totally at home. He did fabulous work. And really had the opportunity to build a big temple in New Delhi with the endorsement of Prime Minister Nehru and all these different things. SRF just absolutely panicked. Because he was just, the simplest way to say it is he was too creative for them. So they threw him out, 1962. Assuming that once he was out of SRF, he would just fade away. Because their whole mindset was that the power was the organization, so immediately as soon as he's removed from it, he will cease to exist. And darn, he just didn't. And that was profoundly annoying. And what gradually has evolved, and now I will skip all the part in the middle, it's two fundamental different theological concepts. One is that spiritual authority passes through the proper channels and is defined by organizational affiliation. And the other is that spiritual authority is a matter of revelation between you and God, and anybody can have it. And it's based on Jesus' simple statement, how do you tell a true prophet from a false? By their fruits you shall know them. Not by their authorization or lack of it. And because Swamiji had now been deauthorized and therefore no longer had the grace of the guru and no longer therefore would have the power of the guru behind him, everything, SRF was just chugging along just fine. But then Swami began to, seem like he had the grace of the guru. And so it became extremely awkward for them. And they never, you know, to her dying day, Diamata, they never had the grace to reconsider their first premises. They just became more and more fixed in their premises. And they became fixed in a way that, I'm trying to think of a respectful way to say it, they became increasingly ludicrous, you know. But to the end, they've held it, and they still hold it, you know, that Swami is a flash in the pan, and this is where the real power and authority is. And we do follow the same teachings. We're both disciples of Master. We follow the same texts. We do the same Kriya practice, and there's, you know, it's much more, you know, vastly more similar than different. But there really is this fundamental, because we're like the Protestants and they're like the Catholics. Although, more truly, we're like the Gnostics and they're like the Catholics from the early years of the Christian church, because that was the same argument then. But then the church won, and they just ate up and obliterated the Gnostics. And so only if you know a little bit do you even know it happened. But that's exactly what's happening right now. As far as we're concerned, it's a big world. There's lots of space for everybody because we don't have a theology that requires them to be invalid. You know, our theology says they can have their interpretation. Everybody can have their interpretation. It's not. We don't have to prove our truth by saying we're the only ones. They unfortunately got themselves into a box in which he undermines their truth. So they've had to, for many years they just did a whisper campaign. It was always just a whisper campaign. Well, if you only really knew, you know, what happened between them. And Swami would say, well, for heaven's sakes, tell everyone, you know, and then he would publish all these accounts of what happened and they would just keep a dignified silence because innuendo was much more effective. And never bring it out in the open. And he wrote all kinds of stories about it. From 1990 until 2002, SRF actually tried very hard to obliterate us through a lawsuit. They tried to sue us out of existence, either by winning on the law, which they had no hope of doing, this being America, and then they tried to win because litigation can be an economic weapon. Litigation can be made so breathtakingly expensive. It doesn't matter who's right or who's wrong, you can bankrupt your opponent. So SRF is very wealthy and Ananda is not, so they set out first to win, and then by 1992, 93, they'd lost everything. What they tried to do was they tried to use intellectual property laws. They trademarked Yogananda's name, they trademarked his photographs, they copyrighted all his writings, and then they accused us of copyright and trademark infringement. It was fun. it was very fun. We did it for a long time. And then they lost all of that. And this is a very long story. Because they had no right. We had to prove that self-realization was a generic term, that Yogananda didn't invent it. We had to just prove a whole lot of things. And then we found out they had actually fraudulently registered Yogananda's writings in the name of SRF. Yogananda, he knew. He registered all the copyrights in his own name, and he never transferred them to SRF. So when he died, he owned them, and they all expired. And then SRF just went to the copyright department and re-registered them as SRF. And our lawyer says to this day that Yogananda whispered in his ear, check the authenticity of those copyrights. And we went to Washington, D.C., and found out they were all fraudulent. So they were all nullified. So SRF, instead of owning everything, owned nothing, which is why you have all of these writings of Master published by Ananda in the first edition of the AY. However, after they lost everything, which was by 1994, they had lost everything, and there was only one legal route that was still open to them, and our lawyers told us, and it's called tarnishment. If they could prove that Ananda was morally reprehensible, and that any association in the mind of the public between Swami Kriyananda, Ananda, and SRF would tarnish SRF's reputation, they had a chance of getting it all back. So Swami said, oh, well then, now comes character assassination. So in 1994, another seemingly unrelated lawsuit in another court was filed, and it was a woman who, at Ananda, had an affair with a married man. When he went back to his wife, she was furious. Let's just put it that way. And when Swamiji supported the man in going back to his wife, she targeted him. She was introduced to the board of directors of SRF. They got a lawyer for her. And this case starts. And this case is that Ananda is, and I'm quoting, a sham organization set up entirely so the Swami can stock his harem with young female devotees. Wow. Yeah, I mean, it was no small potatoes. It was big. And as soon as that lawsuit was filed in state court, in federal court, SRF files a petition saying, well, now that Ananda is engaged in this scandal, we want all our property back. And our lawyer said to the judge, we had a great judge in federal court and a horrible judge in state court, our lawyer says, can you both create a scandal and then benefit from it? This is the question. And the concept legally is unclean hands. So we demanded to be able to take Diamata's deposition about SRF's involvement in this lawsuit. Now, from their point of view, number one, they believed the lies this woman told them because all they ever heard from, if you spoke well of Ananda to any SRF leader, you were considered to be out of tune and a liar. So the only reports they've ever gotten in 40 years are all negative, so they believe this woman. She just made out of whole cloth this whole story about what a reprehensible place Ananda is and what the word is sexual predator Swami Kriyananda is. And they believed her, and they backed the lawsuit. So Diamata faked a reconciliation between us to get out of her deposition. She acted as if it was all over between us, and as soon as she was secure from not having her deposition taken, all of that was dropped. And that lawsuit went until 1998, and we lost that one. We lost that one because of the judge. We were not allowed to present a defense, which sounds incomprehensible, but that's what happened. We were not allowed to defend ourselves against any charge of misconduct against Swami Kriyananda. All the witnesses knew that before they spoke, and the jury was never told why we didn't present a defense. So, why we didn't present a defense. As Swami said, yes. We could have appealed. We would have won. But in the American courts, what you get when you appeal is you get a new trial, which they would have loved because it was in the newspaper every single day. It was, you know, all you have to do is accuse in America. You don't have to prove. And so we lost. And then, you know, we had to pay a lot of money. But we thought about appealing, but we were absolutely broke at that point. And now it really became litigation as a weapon. And by the time, just before that verdict came in, the lawyer filed 8 more lawsuits against us, against every branch of Ananda and against all of us as individual leaders. I mean, you know, it was just litigation as a weapon. And the only thing that would stop it was to go into bankruptcy and just stop it. So we played that all out. During that period of time, Ananda expanded more, was more creative and more expansive. It was the most fruitful, expansive period in Ananda's history. Swami says, if you tell enough untruth, truth has to come out somewhere. Then, meanwhile, the SRF lawsuit is also sort of playing around in the background, and it went all the way to 2002. So we did 12 years of litigation, at the end of which all of Master's teachings were totally liberated for the whole world. When the thing started, nobody dared to do anything because SRF would always threaten to sue you. At the end of it, they had lost everything. Absolutely everything. Things that nobody even knew were in doubt were absolutely. And since 2002, Master's name, picture, Sri Yukteswar, Babaji, it's just exploded all over the world. You pick up any New Age magazine and you find all these different. And before 2002, you couldn't find that because SRF had a death grip on it. So then, as soon as they stopped suing us, we were just perfectly happy because we only had to defend ourselves. We had to spend $13 million. About 300 people whose average income is about $25,000 a year put out 11 of the 13 million. It's taken us a few years. We still have a debt on that. But
is this owed to SRF?
No, it's just owed to our attorneys and to the thises and the thats and to the we borrowed it. We just borrowed it from everybody and mortgaged. They didn't sign his name. No, he was still spelling his name right because everything at that point was written by him. But that's the long answer. The short answer is they're doing their work, we're doing ours. If you ask them about us, if you ask any rank and file SRF person, you will like everybody who's in SRF that you meet. They're extremely nice people. They follow a great teaching. They have wonderful hearts. They like us. We like them. It's very confusing. It's like Protestants and Catholics in Ireland. It's like Muslims and Hindus in India. It's like, we all like each other. What is this about? But, you know, there's powers that be who have their own force of energy, their own trajectory.
Who's in charge there now? I didn't know she died.
She died in November, and the obvious next is Mrinalini Mata, who had been vice president, and who is there's only one other of that crowd of women who is still alive, which is Uma Mata. So there was Daya, Mrinalini, and Uma left living. Daya died, Then Marina Lini has taken over. She's 80 and not in very good health, but she's exactly like Diamata, so there's no change yet. Rank and file just think the whole thing is ridiculous. Truthfully, most of the rank and file do not understand what the difference is. You know, what I just explained to you, most people in SRF don't know that. Many people at Ananda don't even know it in the sense that they haven't really thought it through. I was on the legal team and I had to think it through. I had to understand. But they don't understand that there really is a genuine theological conflict here. And every American church starts as one, then usually somebody who's close in branches off, and then he starts his own, and then the people who had the monopoly try to squelch the one who's started it, and then usually he manages to wiggle free, and then you have the First Church of Christ Scientists and the Second Church, you know, and I'm sure you all know this, and then you have the first Reformed version of the Second, you know.
Threw him out to begin with, didn't they?
Say again?
Didn't they throw him out to begin with?
They threw him out to begin with, but they thought he would disappear. They never. This is a nightmare beyond imagination of expectancy, what actually happened. You know, they never thought this would happen. Swami says, because he's such a good leader, he said it was very unwise of them because they gambled everything on one throw of the dice. He said they should have been more strategic. He just speaks to us as leaders. You know, don't gamble as big as they did. If you want to make something happen, don't count on it so completely. It's not wise as a leader. It wasn't a rational decision. The reason they did it is because Master wanted him out, because Swami could never have done anything inside of SRF ever. We just couldn't. They were just too out of tune with each other.
Master wanted him out.
Master was not alive at that point, but Master engineered his dismissal from the astral plane. Because Swami needed to be on his own.
He's just so creative in his mission of, you know, establishing, you know, communities, and this wouldn't have manifested.
And, you know, then coming back to what Savitri said, SRF is run by traditional monastics, you know, monks and nuns of a very traditional style, and they are very Catholic in their monasticism, extremely Catholic, you know, obedience to your superior kind of suppression of self-will. They consider to be the same as overcoming
and they
the ego.
Either, could they?
No, that traditional celibate order, and Ananda is based on Master's ideal of cooperative communities. So you see us as being couples and family oriented, and SRF not. But that's a small, you know, that's not enough reason for the division. The division is really because they box themselves into a corner, and
they never had the humility.
It was theological with them. I never had any difficulty understanding where they got themselves. What they never had was the humility to see their mistake. They never had the honesty to really investigate the issue. They just had a position, and then they had to defend it. And they thought, once they sued us, they never thought we would survive. And only by the grace of God did we survive.
Well, it sounds like they wanted to control Paramahansa's teachings.
You bet. That's the Catholics. It's just so like, you're kidding. You haven't really taken Yogananda's teachings. You don't really think it's meant to be another Catholic church, do you? But you get close to it and you find, my goodness, they do. So, you know, more power to them. The people who are in it love it. And it's,
you can imagine the Catholic Church trying to copyright the name of Jesus Christ. You know?
That's pretty much what we wrote in the papers. You know, imagine if the Protestants or the Lutherans or the Catholics said they own the name Jesus Christ. Like, how much sense would that make? You know, of course, nobody in the courts had any idea. And so we had to educate them from the ground up. But the federal judge, who was the real key judge, he really got it. He was really smart. The reason we lost in the state court is we had such a great judge in the federal court. We thought that all judges were good. And we thought if we just persevered and kept saying the truth, pretty soon it would come out. And this judge, as it turns out, wanted to be promoted. This is what we finally really understood. Wanted to be promoted. Saw the possibility of a real high-profile case, but it would only serve him if we were guilty. So he basically acted like an attorney for the other side. And everything went wrong. Swami would said to us, look, the law of averages says that at least some things will go your way. You know, you can have a string of bad luck, but you have a little bit of good luck. He says, when absolutely everything goes against you, which it did in that case, you know that Divine Mother is just toying with you.
Yeah.
So there was a lot going on that even now I just don't really know what it was. But last night I like to refer to this in a perverse sort of way, Because people who are going to try to persuade you that you're into something bad will tell you about it. Because everything's still alive on the internet. So they'll be able to tell you, oh, those people, you're not involved with them, are you? Don't you realize what happened? So let me be the first to tell you.
So Swami was actually accused of...
He was never accused, he was never personally sued, and he was never actually accused or convicted of anything except craving an environment in which abuse could take place. And the case was really about this woman and this man, but in about a heartbeat, it just moved over to an attack on Swami because that was the intention behind it. SRF didn't give a hoot about this woman, but it was an incredible vehicle for going after Swami. And if the judge had been in the state court, had been like the judge in the federal court, it wouldn't have been such a circus. But, you know, he wanted a circus. And the trial took place a few miles from our community. I don't know. Every so often I try to find her on the internet or something like that. She was from New Zealand. I believe she went back to New Zealand. I have to tell you something that I'm real proud of. The day of the verdict, which, you know, we held out hope. We tried to hold out hope, but it was pretty faint hope. The day of the verdict, we're all sitting in the courtroom and they tell us the verdict. And the verdict is, it's pretty clear in a minute that they've convicted us of being morally reprehensible. And my first thought was, oh my goodness, not only has this woman lies, but she's won. And I just felt so bad for her because she did this horrible thing. And then it worked for her. So that just meant that instead of being stopped, she was just going to keep going forward.
And rewarding bad behavior.
Yeah, her bad behavior, because the karma trajectory was there. But she was just not a good person. And I can't imagine that anything has worked out for her. But nobody knows. Well, that was a lot more about that than you probably wanted to know. You asked me a very different question.
I knew it was more than just communal living versus monastic living.
I guess I just wanted, you know, it's really hard when it's so personal, but I what made me think when you were talking about that was, and I'm not really good at all the Indian stories, so you...
That's all right.
But there was some god that wanted to, in the philosophy that wanted to get closer to
Rama.
Yeah.
You mean that Ravana was really a devotee of Rama because
Rama
was his enemy, and therefore he would be, if Rama was his arch enemy, his mind would always be on Lord Rama.
Yeah.
And I think that's how stories get turned into myths. And it's a lovely story. I wish I could find an analogy in this situation. I can't. This was just karma. And Swamiji writes about it. He just says it was my karma.
Yeah.
You know, in the past, things happened, and now I had to pay them back, and it's fine. I'm grateful for everything. I mean, it was hard. I'm not going to say it wasn't. Mm-hmm. Those were very interesting. 12 years, long time.
And money is still owed to attorneys?
Well, money is still owed to our own people. We borrowed money in every direction we could think of, including mortgaging our church building in Palo Alto. Everything was private. We got money from every person in the world who would loan us money, and we've just been paying it back. And we're okay. I mean, if anybody wants to help, go right ahead. But, yeah.
If I win the lottery, I'll keep that in mind.
So, any other questions? Another subject completely? Okay.
I asked this question to Mark and Maya Tree, and they said to ask you.
Okay.
Because it was easier.
I don't mind.
She has a much better explanation.
Right.
Okay.
So I, as you know, in 1987 I learned the basic meditation techniques, and then when Maya Tree was living at Ananda, I took a Kriya preparation course.
Uh-huh.
And I was approved to receive Kriya training, but then they told me I had to commit to Yogananda being my guru for the rest of my life. And
uh-huh.
I wasn't comfortable making that commitment.
Right.
And this was 20 years ago.
Right.
And so I've never learned the Kriya yoga technique. And when you mentioned it earlier today, I thought, you know, I would like to learn that technique. But I still don't know if I can make that commitment. You know,
mm-hmm.
Even though here I am,
20 years.
I was going to say, it's a shorter commitment now than it was 20 years ago.
I take commitment seriously, you know. Uh-huh. So it's just like, I don't know if I can commit to anything for the rest of my life. And so why does one have to make that commitment in order to learn the Kriya Yoga technique?
Because Kriya is discipleship. Because Kriya is discipleship. There's no such thing as Kriya without discipleship. I mean, we can declare that, why can't I have Kriya without discipleship? Well, why can't I have one eye instead of both of them? Why can't I have one ear instead of two? Because this is the way we're made. Kriya is a technique that we actually do ourselves, but the power of Kriya is attunement with the Guru. And what Kriya does for us is it puts us in tune with the Guru, and then by the Guru's grace, we're changed. As the Bible says, as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. Which is, it's an interesting statement. You have to receive Jesus before you can become liberated. I mean, that's what that actually means. Jesus is the Guru. It's the Guru's power. Attunement with the Guru is the power that actually transforms you, because the ego itself does not have the power to dissolve itself. There has to be another force brought in, and that force has to be of a higher vibration that changes our vibration. The grace of God, we call it, the grace of Guru, it becomes specific. Kriya is the technique that focuses and aligns our energy sufficiently that we can receive that ray. But if we merely align ourselves, there has to be then something that we receive. And the relationship between the disciple and the Guru has to be one of receptivity on the part of the disciple, because divine law prohibits the Guru forcing his will upon the disciple, and because the consciousness that we have has to be our chosen commitment, we have to lift ourselves into that vibration. So we have to make an effort. But the vibration emanating through the Guru is just part of the formula. And we may say, oh, I can do it myself. I want to go directly to God. Why do I need an intermediary? We can say all those things. We can assert them with all the force in the world. The answer is, when somebody asks Swami Kriyananda, you know, why do I need a guru? He says, not if you don't think so. You know, like, go ahead. See if it works. But the first line of Autobiography of a Yogi, I'll try to quote it exactly, but the characteristic feature of Indian culture has always been the search for eternal verities and the concomitant disciple-guru relationship. Meaning, once you start looking for eternal truth, you run into the disciple-guru relationship. Everyone usually quotes that as guru-disciple, but it's actually disciple-guru, because the guru's already there. He doesn't come first. You have to be the disciple first. So there's no way to give you Kriya without discipleship, because we're not giving you Kriya. Now, the other half of your question is, I'm afraid to commit. I don't know if I can commit. God is no tyrant, is the actual answer to that. Which is, if you're sincere in what you're doing, even if you're insecure in your capacity to keep the commitment, God is no tyrant. And if you're acting with goodwill, with the best that you know in the moment, and you're not taking it frivolously. You see, also there's a necessity to protect people from their own inadvertent error, you know, their own airheadedness. Which is, oh, sure, I'll take Kriya, why not? You know, it's a real thing, and it's a real power. It's not to be messed around with. So people have to align themselves with some serious energy, or else it's inappropriate. I don't want to be too harsh, but pearls before swine is how Jesus put it. You know, it's just not a good idea. It's not good for the person. It's bad karma. And I don't mean it's bad karma to sincerely try and then not be up to the task. That's just karma. But to be flippant about something that should be sacred is not good. So those responsible for initiating and so on have to be respectful of what's really being offered. But for you to say, I don't know about myself, which is to say, I don't have confidence in myself, is not necessarily a reason for you not to go forward. You know, and it's a delicate balance. If you can't master enough willpower to really feel that you're going to make your best effort, then maybe you have to hold back. if you know you're going to make your best effort, but just have this superstitious anxiety about being damned to hell if I don't make it.
Right, I was raised Catholic, so that probably has something to do with it.
That's something to be overcome. Because that's the tyrant image of God, which is he's going to ask the impossible of me, and when I fail, he's going to burn me forever. You know, it's like, who wants to, I mean, oh, let's all become atheists. I mean, that is a really intelligent reason to become an atheist.
I think another thing that was going on with me then, and maybe still is, but, you know, I'm so old, it's I'm getting to pretty late in life, but that it would be nice to have a guru who was in the physical body.
Right.
You know, somebody that I could meet face to face. And
well, sure, but
let's so kind of keep hoping that person would show up.
Well, you know, there's several parts of that. According to the Indian tradition, the guru-disciple relationship lasts more than one incarnation, kind of self-evidently, because it generally takes us a little while to get our act together, and we kind of do it slowly. I mean, we've all changed a lot in one lifetime, but it just takes a long time. I mean, I find that very comforting. I know people say, oh, I don't want to have to incarnate again. I want to be liberated. It's a very nice thought, but I'm a little more realistic than that. I just think about, you know, whatever it is, I'm closer to the end than I am to the beginning, and that's enough for me. An avatar, if you have a truly God-realized master like Jesus or Yogananda or Krishna or Babaji or any of the masters, chances are you're going to be incarnated in a physical body a whole lot more often than he is. I mean, think about it. You know, Yogananda tells us about previous incarnations, but he doesn't come around every 15 or, you know, 50 years or 60 years. The avatar plants his message, and then it carries for a long time. Many, many people still reach extremely high states of consciousness as disciples of Jesus, because time and space is no obstacle for a master. Now, that's the first part. So if I'm going to always want a guru in the body, that means I'm going to have to be flipping around all the time. And I'm often going to be settling for a lot less, just because so-and-so happens to be incarnated, whereas Jesus is not. So that's half the answer. The other half of the answer is that the master works through his disciples. So think if you were there when St. Francis was there. Francis did not declare himself a guru, although he probably was to those close to him, but his entire devotion was to Jesus. But if you were with St. Francis, boy, did Francis help you get to Jesus. And then after him, Brother Leo, and, you know, all the others that were left behind him, all of them acted as the instrument. So do you need personal assistance? You bet you do. Absolutely. We all need personal assistance. That's what I said last night, remember? If you really want help with your intuition, cultivate friends. Cultivate people, and I use the phrase a community. We call our group now, we've sort of changed our name to the Community for Self-Realization. Because one of the things we realize that people don't get, they get the self-realization part, but they don't get the fellowship part. They don't understand. They think of the fellowship as friendship. They think of community as us all having meals together and, you know, and knowing each other's children and being friends like that. And yes, that's true. But what community really is a shared commitment to self-realization and the help that we give and support we give each other in that. And I think that's essential. So that essential desire that I've got to make this manifest to me in some specific way and be able to have access to some kind of living representative or channel of that is absolutely true. And when Sue was asking how to introduce me last night, she said, shall I say you're a disciple of Yogananda? And I always say, I'm a disciple of Yogananda through Swami Kriyananda, because it's the truth. It's like Swami Kriyananda will not take the role of guru, but I don't know Yogananda except through Swami Kriyananda. I would never have known Yogananda except through Kriyananda, and everything I know about Yogananda has come because of Swami Kriyananda, so it's just the honest way for me to say that. And even somebody wrote me a letter. I, among other things you find on the website is I've been answering all these questions that people ask. Somebody wrote a letter and said, well, ask me, would you be my guru? She was a new person, and it was a very... And I didn't just brush it off, because I knew why she asked that. She asked that because, you know, she's 20 years old, I'm 64. She's been on the path for 6 months. I've been on the path for 40 years. I mean, it was a natural request. I said, no, because even Swami Kriyananda won't take the role of guru because this path was started by an avatar and we don't want to dilute it. But, so it's just not appropriate. I don't have the state of consciousness, and if Swami's not going to take that role, for heaven's sakes, I'm sure not going to take that role. But let's phrase the question differently. Will I do my best to help you as you progress on this path? Absolutely. And you know, we're brothers and sisters on this path, and we're all going to help each other. And if we want that help, then we'll give it wholeheartedly to each other. And everybody has something to give in that way. And more than you believe from where you sit, that's enough. It's a lot more than you think it is. Yes?
How does the jiva...
Mm-hmm. Good, I love that. I'm getting that word into the vocabulary.
Enmeshed with the ego. That's
uh-huh.
How does it know which is the proper guru?
There's several ways to tell. I mean, if it resonates with you, if the teaching is attractive to you, if the teaching makes sense to you, if you feel some kind of an attunement with the representatives of that path, if any of the pictures on the altar attract you. You know, people tend to think about Yogananda, but he always spoke of it as a line of gurus. Many people, their attunements with Sri Yukteswar or Babaji or Jesus, many devotees of Jesus find their way to here. And then you can be a disciple of Jesus through Yogananda. You know, because Yogananda... Well, it's your own inner relationship. If you become a disciple of this path, you are becoming a disciple of this line of gurus. That's how Master always put it. That's why I was saying we say Yogananda most of the time, but he actually spoke of the line of masters. And many people who are devoted to Jesus, when Master was alive, would take discipleship, you know, of Jesus through him. So that's one thing. Another way you can tell about the spiritual path is you look at the people who follow it and you ask yourself, just literally, do these people seem like family to me? You know, I know a lot of people say you just come here and it's like, it feels like family. We just know each other. So there is a karmic attunement with these people. And then also, are these people attractive to me? And I don't mean attractive in an egoic sense, but is their magnetism something that I want to be part of? Because often we're not advanced enough to judge whether the master is true or not, whether he's embodied or not, but by its fruit, by his fruit, you shall know it. And if you see in all those people who are dedicated to this what you want to become, you can be certain that if you follow this path, you will become like those who follow it. All of Krishna's soldiers look like Krishna. So sometimes, and it was very interesting to me when Ananda became attractive to people who had never even met Swami Kriyananda. They were attracted by all of those he trained. And it was very gratifying because Master passed his ray to Swami, Swami's passed the ray on down to some of us, and now we're able to pass it to others. And now, of course, Swami's 85, and almost, you know, very few people have much access to him anymore because he's really pretty seclusive. He does a few public programs a year, you know, in one country or another, but what you read about in that book is, unfortunately, pretty much gone. It's just gone. Time passes. Does that mean that the whole vibration that he created will die now? That would be tragic. But the fruit is all around you, and that's how you know. You can take discipleship to a path because of what you see in the other disciples. And what I did, even when I came to Ananda, I did not have any idea what my relationship was to Yogananda. I'd been devoted to Ramakrishna. But I knew that Swami Kriyananda could teach me, and I was going to be where he was, period. And, I mean, he was so low-key about his own role, especially in those days. There was no question about him being my guru or anything like that out of the question. He was 44. He was a young man. He was just doing this dynamic work. But I knew he could teach me. And I said to Ramakrishna and Yogananda in my meditation, you guys sort this out. I mean, it's like, I knew what I was supposed to do, so I did it.
So you didn't have to pick one person that was your guru?
I didn't know what to do about any of it. I knew what I was supposed to do today. And I was supposed to be where Swami Kriyananda was, because he was going to teach me what I wanted to know. Here's another thing. I couldn't tell more than that, because I didn't have the intuition to know. Why didn't I have the intuition to know? Because I was such a mess. And the only way I was going to stop being such a mess was to do something to make myself less of a mess. And so I went to Ananda Village to work with Swami Kriyananda because I knew he would make me less of a mess. To use his own words, you're a lot less confused than you used to be. And he was right. And so I'd been there maybe a year or more. I woke up one morning, I said, of course this is your path. What could you have been thinking? You know, but I never worried about it. It's just like I did what the needful, and then I woke up one day and it was self-evident.
So when you took Kriya, did you have to pick one?
Well, you know, things were a lot less formal then. I moved to Ananda in 71, June. In September, he gave Kriya. I said, you know, Swami, can I take Kriya? Oh, sure, he said, just like that. Oh, okay. I mean, I was completely out of it. I don't know why he gave me Kriya. He gave me Kriya because, you know, there I was, and he saw a little potential. I went to Kriya in jeans and a T-shirt. I was so out of it. I didn't even know that you were supposed to wear white. I didn't know anything. I just kind of showed up and took Kriya, you know, and then wandered off. But, you know, God didn't care. And I was hardly even embarrassed. I just kind of looked around and thought, I mean, we're way out in the country and it's so primitive, but I kind of saw that I hadn't really hit the dress code.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When did you actually start teaching once you were with the group, and when did you actually start teaching yourself? How long?
I mean, personally.
Yeah.
Swamiji put me forward pretty fast. Mid-70s, he did a program in San Francisco, big program in San Francisco, and he had me talk, and he had Jyotish talk. There's a picture of us sitting on either side of him, and he was sitting there, and he actually had us answer questions. Me, badly, but he had me answer them. Also, in the early years of Ananda, there was nobody else. You know, it was just a whole crowd of newbies. So it was really the blind leading the blind. He put me in and out of it a few times. He put me into it, and I just couldn't handle it. Too much energy, and I just didn't know what to do with the energy. So I went in and out a couple of times. I really, by the late 70s, early 80s, I was pretty solid in it. I wasn't always doing more good than harm, but I was in it in any case. So he saw it right away, pushed me right away. I did mostly other things, though. No, I wasn't full-time. I became full-time in the early 80s, about the time I married David. Getting married helped stabilize my energy. It was hard being a young woman, young single woman. You know, just it was hard for me not to take it personally. Once I got married, it was just a lot easier. Yeah. Being an old married woman, though, is really nice. Anything else? Being an old Nayaswami is even nicer.
I don't think 64 is old.
I think of my life in quadrants. When I turned 60, I started thinking of myself as 80. It was just more comfortable, you know, and that's where this is going to end. You know, and when you're 80, you're really not young. 60, you can kind of fudge it a little, but 80 is not young. So I just, like, embrace it. But, you know, it doesn't matter.
I'm sure when you spoke about the four levels.
The sudra, that what you're talking about?
The third level you said was self-mastery, right?
Well, the point of the third level is when we begin to realize that the real battle is within us and not with the outside world. So it's not necessarily mastery, but it's at least making the effort toward.
Okay, I just wondered if you'd speak more to what self-mastery is from your viewpoint.
Well, I think self-mastery is the freedom in all circumstances to choose Dharma, to choose that which is actually going to expand our consciousness and not be prevented from making that choice or compelled to make a wrong choice. Compelled by our own desires and our own, well, uncontrollable forces. That's where we're going. But it's a battle. That's what the Bhagavad Gita is. That's what the Mahabharata is. It's this battle between what I was talking about last night, which is all this, the force of everything we've done until now against the force of where we're going. And we live here on the field of Kurukshetra, which is where the battle of the Gita took place, and the two forces fight against each other. And self-mastery is being able to consistently discern, you know, which is going to expand your consciousness and which is going to contract it. Contract it. And then to just be able to always choose that which will expand us. Or if we make a mistake, to have the courage to correct it. And you don't always make the right choice. And that's what self-mastery is. And the lack of self-mastery inhibits everything. You know, it ruins our marriages. It causes us to make wrong choices. It makes us not do enough sadhana. It messes up our finances. It's always a lack of self-mastery. If we're in complete command of ourselves, and I don't mean suppression. I mean just really, we can consciously make the right choice. But heavens, it's hard to do that. So we work at it. But it's very interesting. Makes life extremely interesting. Because we always get to do it. You know, wherever you are, you can be in a dungeon cell all by yourself and you still have the same choice. So it's a portable entertainment system.
Are you selling them?
You already have one. It's a bad business.
I have a question. If we've recently made a choice that didn't expand, and we realized it after the fact, for example, like speaking up to someone that's been, and you know your lesson is speaking up, but you chose not to if they were being abusive,
right.
For example, do you just decide next time I'm going to do it differently, or do you try to go do it different, do something with the person that was...
It just depends. That's a real personal choice, which is going to do more good. If you know, Yogananda put it this way, if you know that no matter how hard you try, you're going to be defeated, he said, run away. Because it doesn't help you to be defeated.
But yet you're still taking sort of the cowardly.
No, it's not cowardly. He said it's the better part of wisdom. If you know, if the battle is too big and you know you can't win it, run away. Because if you're defeated, it injures you and it gets in your mind the thought that you can't do it. You have a defeatist attitude. And if you can't win, it's just foolhardy to go in. Even if you know you need eventually to be able to do it, this is where humility, common sense has to come into play. Patience has to come into play. But don't worry, you'll get a chance.
That's what I was going to
say. Yeah, have no fear. If it's karma that has to be worked out, you can depend on the fact that you'll get a chance to do it. You just need to get out of the ring and you need to go back to the gym and you need to train. And you need to train. One of my lovely phrases is you have to practice when it's easier. And what you have to do is you have to practice all the time, especially when it's easier. Because if you practice when it's easier, you develop the strength to be able that bigger and bigger things become easy. What many people do is they attack the big one, they get completely creamed, they huddle over here, and then they rush back in and think that somehow they're going to be able to do it this time. That's foolhardy. That's egoic, actually. You need to just go off and practice where it's easier. And you just need to sort of flex your little spiritual muscles over here. And, you know, the minutes are more important than the years. The minutes are more important than the incarnations.
I get a little confused about environment versus the
willpower.
The battle.
Uh-huh.
You know, like walking away from a bad environment versus fighting for the...
It becomes a question of individual dharma. See, a lot of time we have a habit of martyrdom. What came up at lunch. And we think that courage is to martyr yourself. Well, not necessarily. Sometimes courage is to say, I don't have to be a martyr. I can just walk away from this. You don't know which way the lesson goes. Sometimes the lesson is that you need to just plant your feet and stand up. And sometimes you need to say, first of all, this is too big for me. And the second is, I don't need this. I'm just going to walk off from this. I don't have to sit in this, whatever it is. I'm finished. And that's where you need other people to help you.
Or intuition.
You need your intuition, and sometimes you need other people to look at you and you say. I mean, because most of your friends know. Usually your friends know when you're just being pig-headed about it. So, you have to pay attention. Because you don't know which way it's going to go. It depends on where you are. What's forward for... The two disciples of Ramakrishna, one needed to hold his temper and one needed to develop a temper. Some people need to develop endurance and the others need to have enough self-worth to say, I don't have to take this. It just depends on where you're standing and what you need. and who you're going to hurt and what's involved and who are they and do you owe them. And you know, there's so many questions. But there's a certain point at which you say, sure, this is an awful environment. I've had it. And then you just wash your hands and go on. With the certainty that whatever you haven't learned, you'll get to learn it. Last night I was saying that when Swami said to me, well, maybe your karma with him is finished, but I don't think so. But you've gone as far as you can go right now, so just go on. That was what he said to me. Just go on now. It'll catch up with you later. Don't worry about it.
Rear its big head again.
Yeah, don't worry. You'll get to work it out. You're not escaping from anything. It's just not right timing now.
I wonder if you could help us a little more with the distinction between being attached to something
right.
and being identified with it.
Right.
It's like your example about the man with his truck was interesting to me because I have an old truck. Mm-hmm. It's 13 years old. You know, after 13 years in Texas sun, the paint is starting to go and everything.
Yeah.
I kind of tell myself, it's like, I don't care. It gets me from point A to point B.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It's working. Fine, I'm just going to drive it until it quits and then I'll get something else. But at the same time, I sometimes feel kind of embarrassed by it.
Right.
You know, because, you know, people drive their nice cars and everything. You know, it's like, and I'm wondering, okay, am I actually still identified with it in a way because I'm embarrassed by its appearance?
Well, what you're attached to is people's opinion of you and what they might think of you. The truck is an inanimate object. Mm-hmm. But when you're in it, animate objects, people around you have opinions, and their opinions wobble your self-esteem. And so the issue is, what is the basis of your self-esteem? And, you know, and then you have to decide whether this is a battle worth fighting,
right.
And whether you should just get rid of the truck.
It's not a big issue.
No, I don't understand.
I don't stress about this all the time.
But right, but that's the question, is the truck becomes an opportunity for you to see whether you're vulnerable or not to what other people think. Mm-hmm. And then that becomes the battleground, to be immune to that. You know, I had...
I had an older sister that was very frank with her opinions, and she often told me, you just care too much what other people think, you know.
Well, there's a clue.
Yeah.
She's making friends now.
Yeah, that's like, well, I think we always had a very strong bond between us, so
yeah.
I think she saw that very, very early on.
Yeah, so, you know, driving a funky truck, and I don't know how you feel about this, Maitri, and I don't want to take sides here. My father was very attached to a really old car that embarrassed the heck out of my mother. And when I accidentally, at 16 years of old, had a very small crash with it, she was so pleased because it wasn't worth repairing. So I don't want to get in here. But, you know, if you are too concerned about what people think, driving a funky truck could be just the right size of a test. You could do it deliberately just for the fun of it. You know, that's a practice when it's easier, if you want to, if it's appropriate. I'm not even saying it is, but that's a you know, I'll just play with this. Instead of doing something really, really scary, I'll just drive this funky truck and try to let them whisper about me and not have it bother me. Yeah.
So, but I'm still a little bit confused about the distinction between...
Attachment and identification. Well, because there's no real clear, bright line in the sand.
Okay.
We're trying to make a clear, bright line. There are two, and because you can be Yogananda was identified sufficiently with his body that he knew which one he was supposed to run. But there was no attachment to it. He identified with it. When it was dissolved, there wasn't the slightest hesitation about letting it go. If he'd been attached to that body, which is attached to the relationships that had been created by it, to the sense of status that was associated with the position that he'd created, that would be attachment to it. Because happiness would be conditioned by it. You know, and so the main thing that attachment does is it says, you know, I have to have this or something else is going to happen. If you're identified with something, and it's just a little bit false, but it's a little bit there. You're identified with your body, but then when your body dies, you just don't identify with it anymore. And there would be a little bit of a tinge if you were identified with it. The more you're identified with the infinite, the more you can casually let your body go. But the more attached you are, the more difficult that separation's going to be. So I would say it could be a matter of degree. But you could just as easily say she was deeply identified with being a movie star. And it's really the same. It's virtually the same as being attached. We're really splitting hairs to try to split them too far apart.
Okay.
But when you say attached, it brings in a little more. It's more of a pejorative statement than to say identified with. It's more clear to discuss it as identity. Identified than attached. And that's the only reason we separate it. Okay.
Is meditation the best way to get over
attachments? Everything is the best way to get over attachments. You know, just wide awake living. Meditation sure helps because meditation dissolves the vrittis in the chakras. Attachment. See, attachment is an attitude of consciousness. Because you can't really be attached to any of this, because when the jiva withdraws, it's all gone. So you can't, you can have
it.
It's, well, no, it's an attitude of the mind. I mean, you can die and still be desperately attached. You know, and then a lot of people reincarnate in the same families. Because, you know, you're the grandmother here and you're just so desperately attached to this group that you just show up at the baby at the other end. And, I mean, lots of people realize, oh, my God, this is grandma. You know, she has the same birthmark. She has the same, you know, way of being. And often it is grandma. Because grandma just died thinking of nothing but this family. And the first little bit of, you know, first time she saw a sperm and ovum unite, wham, she was right in there again, you know. Because she was ripped out, but she never gave up. You know, and then you get your mansion back. You get the whole thing again. It's the truth. Death doesn't do anything for you. Really, Swami just said once, death is nothing. It does nothing for you. It just takes off your body, and your consciousness is exactly what it is. So it's all internal. It's all vrittis, which are vortices of energy in the chakras. And the chakras are not physical. The chakras are your astral body. So the word identify is important because we are identified with our physical body, but we are also identified with our astral body, which is the chakra system. So when the physical body dies, we carry the chakra system, which is our astral body. Our ego remains attached to the chakras. It goes into the astral world, but then we're identified with our astral body. And you have to lose that too when we move into the causal world, but mostly we're just going back and forth to the physical. And we live in that astral body, and then we get the chance to come back into the physical body because we have all these unresolved desires that can only be fulfilled in the physical world, unresolved karma. So then we find another physical body that reflects the pattern in the chakras, and then we live a whole nother incarnation. But meditation can affect the astral body. And when you affect the astral body, you change the blueprint. And that's the blueprint that manifests the physical body, just like you build a building. This building was built because somebody had a thought of building it. They made a blueprint, and then they manifested it. So we are a thought in the causal world. We become a blueprint in the astral world. We become a physical body in the physical world. Change the blueprint, you change the body. So by meditation, even in a physical body, by the application of subtle energy, you can change even the body, even after it's built. But you can also gradually affect the blueprint, which will not only affect the manifestation now, but then when you leave with the blueprint, you'll really have a new blueprint. And then the next time you start over at a different spot. That's why I'm not too worried about how many more bodies I have to make, because I'm working really hard on the blueprint. And the blueprint gets better and better. I mean, it hasn't been bad this time. It's been a great experience. You know, I've had a lot more fun than not, and I'll take it again.
Clarification. I guess I'm kind of.
Sure.
I need clarification on the difference between the soul.
Yeah.
Jiva.
Right.
And the ego.
Okay.
Well, what's the relationship?
The word jiva is a Sanskrit word, and we usually use the word soul, and you could call them synonyms. Okay. I just think that the soul is a little bit inexact because the soul can also mean our infinite self. And the jiva is a more exact word. The jiva is the bubble in the ocean, and the bubble is comprised only of the ocean, but the bubble's a distinct reality. The bubble is that little piece of the infinite that we have individualized and call ourselves. And then when the jiva, which is that spark of the infinite, takes on a physical body, ego is the infinite individuality identified with a body. And so there's physical ego, and then there's also astral ego, because the jiva is still identified with the body even after the physical body dies. It's then identified with the astral body. These chakras are mine. This energy pattern is mine. And it's because we're identified with it, it hovers around us. Because everything that happens, we identify with, and that identification, which is ego, is a magnetic force which holds all these experiences in the pattern around us. And when you dissolve the ego, when the jiva realizes, oh, I just thought I was this body, physical and astral. I'm not really this body. I've always been the ocean. The bubble and the ocean are the same. The whirling magnetic force that has held all this karma in place, if the karma is circling around this and the center point around which it's circling evaporates, then all that energy just disperses. And the act of meditation weakens this center point, weakens it in the positive sense, which is we begin to identify larger, and the intensity of that, of the ego, begins to dissolve. And the extent to which that force of separateness begins to weaken, then all the karma, see, this is all relationships of magnetic energy. You know, I was talking about solar systems. There's the force that's wanting to move away, and then there's gravity which holding in place, and it's a very delicate balance, isn't it? And if you change the gravitational pull at the center point, which is the hold that ego has, everything that's a little stronger to move away from you and dissolve into the infinite will be released at that point. And that works through the chakra system. That's why often when people start meditating, you experience tremendous changes, just like almost effortless changes. Something will happen that would always cause a certain reaction in you, and you'll just think, wow, I just didn't react the same at all. Or somebody will offer you something that was always tempting to you before, and if there's no discipline involved, you're just not interested. Because the work that you've been doing in the spine to raise and magnetize your energy at a higher vibration is having its effect even if you didn't know it. Because every time you meditate, and especially every time you do Kriya, which is a specific technique where you consciously and deliberately change the magnetism in the spine, it's all magnetic relationships. If the inward and upward moving energy becomes slightly stronger than that energy, if the river is flowing like this and the whirlpools are like this, it's able to stay a whirlpool because of its relationship to the flow of the river, right? The river gets stronger, the whirlpool just gets sucked into the river. And the whirlpool, the energy is not gone, but the whirlpool is gone. So two things happen. You're no longer deflected, and also the forward moving current gets stronger. And that's what you begin to feel. You just begin to feel you have more energy for the positive and less inclination for what was drawing you away. And that's meditation, Kriya Yoga especially, but that's all meditation. You can see how, like, wow, that's a very efficient way to deal with it, isn't it? Otherwise, you dive into the whirlpool, you swim around for a long time, you struggle with the debris, you try to get it on the bank, you get drawn under again, you get back into the river, you get thrown over to the side. Let's just increase the flow of the river. You meditate at the spiritual eye, you keep increasing the flow of the river, and all them little whirlpools, they just get eaten up by that river, and you're somebody else. I do. I like it here. If I lived here too long, when I go back, they would really tease me. I went into a drugstore with Swamiji in Houston, Texas. Somebody said to him in the broadest possible Texan, he started answering him in the same way. He just played out the whole conversation with this really broad accent. I went out and I said, "That was naughty, Swamiji." He said, "I just couldn't resist." He says, if you get the accent, you get the consciousness. That's one of his rules about learning languages. Work hard on the accent, he said, because if you get the accent, you get the consciousness, then the language will flow from it. I mean, I only speak English, so I don't know. He speaks 8 languages. So. Yeah. He says, in fact, he used to say this about Savitri. She said, you can always recognize Texans because in order to talk like that, they have to hold their mouth in a certain way. And he would see, sort of point to the region. I don't know what that way is. He said, the only way you can talk like that is if your mouth is just turned in a certain way. Well, we may have ended this chapter, do you think? I think we're at our time limit. There's a story in the Bible, St. Paul. This is in the Acts of the Apostles. St. Paul goes to talk somewhere. He's a very, very popular speaker. And they describe it. He's in a second floor room. It's a hot night. There's so many people coming to see him. The windows are all open. People are crowded. They're sitting on the windowsills. Apparently, Paul was really, really talkative. Some of you may remember this from Acts of the Apostles. So he just talks and talks, and he talks and talks and talks, and it gets way into midnight. Hours have gone by. Some poor man sitting in one of those windows falls asleep, falls out the window, hits the ground, and dies. Like, dies. Paul talked him to death. I think that's like an amazing concept. But fortunately, Paul could resurrect him. So Paul went out, and he touched him, and he brought him back to life. So my rule of thumb as a public speaker is if you can't resurrect them, don't talk them to death. So it's 2 minutes to four, and I think that's enough for today. Okay.
You can tell that tomorrow service again, and we promise we won't laugh till the end.
When I read that, I couldn't believe it. I had to read that story several times. That's what it says. It's right there. The Bible says it's true. I love it. You know, the human element of that is so just
actually in the Acts of the Apostles.
It's actually in the Acts of the Apostles. I mean, I'm not wrong, am I?
No, it is.
It's there. Yeah, I've reread it several times because every so often I doubt that can't really be there. And then I go back and find it again. Okay. No.
That's not one you hear read in church on Sunday.
No, but it's marvelous.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine if you were sitting there and you just look around, whoops, fell out the window, you know, and the whole crowd must have rushed downstairs, you know.